Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for all things Kings of War. Join your hosts Rob Fanoff and Mark Zielinski as they delve into the world of Mantica and bring you in-depth coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Andy Ransom, A-list celebrity and Orange Legend.
And I'm Rob Fanoff. So as you've just heard, we finally got the A-list celebrity we've been looking for, Mr. Andy Ransom, on the show. Andy, welcome to the show.
It is something of an honor. And I will tell you, as far as Kings of War podcasts go, Countercharge is comfortably top 10.
I was going to say top 20. Top 10 works too. That's quite the honor.
Now that you've got me on the show, I think you can make that push towards top 5.
I hope so. Trying to get some of your millions of your hordes of fans to come over and listen to us, even for just a brief moment.
I do have hordes of fans, yes.
So Andy, why don't you introduce yourself and maybe explain to the audience your channel?
Well, for the one or two of you that may have been living under a wargaming rock for the last 5 years, my channel is Andy2D6, and I put out a plethora of juicy content, a lot of it for Kings of War, battle reports, tournament reports, where I go into in-depth analysis of all of my games, going over all my tactical moves and genius, among the other game systems that I cover, mainly Age of Sigmar, but there's also a smattering of other things in there from time to time. I play a lot of different games, but lately it's been all about Kings of War and Age of Sigmar.
One of my club mates, Billy Smith, put me onto you, and great battle reports, great tournament coverage, thoughtful analysis with a comedy spin, I think, at times. So it's quite the endeavor you have over there.
I think that's a fair assessment. And did you know that my channel actually won the Warhammer YouTubers Award for Best Battle Reporter 2016?
So how are we looking for 2017?
I don't know. Because when you win an award, occasionally there's a bit of a backlash for the people that don't enjoy your content, and then they all kind of pull together and vote for somebody else next time. So there could be a bit of that going on. But I do have quite the sizable following.
Let's jump into a hobby update. Do you squeeze any painting, any hobby in?
Well, I have been squeezing in an excessive amount of hobbying lately, actually. People who've been looking on Facebook may have seen that I've been retraying my entire undead army. So it's now 100% suitable for Kings of War. No tray lips that make the unit slightly bigger than it should be. So there's no debate about whether it's a fraction of a millimeter away from the objective or whether it's in charge range. Because I've ordered some custom bases where I've taken basically the front rank and file out of the unit and then split that. So there's a lip on all sides to actually pick up the unit, but it still takes the exact amount of space that the unit is supposed to. It just has less models in it. And then with units that only have two ranks, you obviously can't do that because it had dropped below the almighty minimum model count. So I've just got the lips on the side there, so just so I've got something to grip. So I've been working on those. That didn't take much work. And also, slightly more secret project, I've bought some other trays, which were slightly cheaper because they're just flat pieces of wood, which I'm going to be using to, as sacrilegious as this may be, use my Age of Sigmar Stormcast Eternals as ogres for Kings of War. So I just need to get those bases painted up now. They're going to be magnetized on there. So that's going to be exciting. And that's all I've been doing Kings of War-wise at the moment.
Actually, I played a gentleman at an event in January, and that's what he did. He had a Stormcast in for ogres. And they actually, from a scale size, they actually work quite well.
They do. It's a really bizarre list I'm going to have to use, though, to get to 2,000 points, because I don't have that many models to choose from. So I'm having to use a Star Drake as a Chariot Horde, which is an interesting idea.
Maybe you should stop at Chariot Horde for ogres. That's an interesting unit that you don't typically see with ogres.
I don't think I've ever seen anyone use an ogre Chariot Horde.
Certainly not winning with it, so you'll be the first.
If I can squeeze something out of it, then maybe it'll encourage others to give it a try. Because on paper, it doesn't sound that bad, actually.
Yeah, I think the issue is just the footprint is so large that it usually gets chaffed up, and then it's really hard to, you know, it's hard for you to deliver the payload, basically.
It is quite enormous, although you do have a little bit of freedom, especially if you put a nice artifact on it. Maybe you could give it Nimble, something like that.
Yeah, Nimble, Caterpillar, There's a few artifacts that would make it
because
more
the
effective.
Footprint of the unit, the overall shape, it makes it slightly more difficult to stop in its tracks than, say, a horde that's really wide of just the regular ogres.
Because it's so deep rather than wide.
Or a legion, should I say, would be the one that's obscenely wide that you're not going to be able to do any kind of pivoting shenanigans with. But the chariot horde is actually quite long.
Best of luck with that. Sounds like an interesting... I'm sure Darren Parks will completely appreciate the army.
I'm sure he will. I one of these days I do want to make an army that's kind of a tribute to him with just nothing but dinosaurs in it. I did inspire someone else to call their army that's similar to that Jurassic Parks.
So hobby on my end, it seems like I'm always hobbying, but we're preparing for Lone Wolf, which is next weekend. We'll have 90 players. I've just finished a display board for Mr. Dan King so that he doesn't have to go through the trials and tribulations that the rest of the UK contingent are going through to bring display boards over to the US. Don't forget, we have the Blue Sea Brawl in June. If you've registered, lock in by paying. We're doing a couple new tables up. One's a nautical theme with sea monsters and a wrecked ship, and we've got another jungle board, so it's awesome. And finally, I did want to mention the ATC, the American Team Championships. The registration is open for that. 6 rounds, 2,500 points, 3-player teams. It is official by Mantic, run by Community Pad himself. And to get more information, whatc.org, which I believe stands for Warhammer ATC, because if you don't know, there will be 300 or 400 40K players at this event. Kings of War will be but a small little piece of that. So I think that's it for a hobby. Andy, you got anything else?
Is it safe to say that display boards are kind of the one contribution that America has made to the wargaming community?
That's the most important contribution. I think the other one is, you know, over here, we typically don't just worry. Like, I know a lot of the UK events are just battle, right? You win by battle points. Whereas over here, we do count, typically we'll count soft scores, which is your hobby and your paint score. We're slowly getting you guys to come on board with that. But yeah, for sure, display boards are, and I understand. I think over there, it's much more difficult to travel, you know, via mass transit with a giant display board. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense.
I did read something on social media about Mr. Nick Williams and his display board. He'd made it slightly too large for his luggage and had to, like, shave the corners off. So that's going to be interesting to see if he can repair that.
Quite a rookie mistake. The very first thing, if you're going to fly with a display board, which I've done a few times, you actually have to measure your suitcase. I think that's the first step. And actually know what the boundaries are. So yeah, but it's a beautiful display board that he has made. He's actually taken it to the next level by actually adding LED lights. So he's become quite the display board wanker.
There are a couple of other things as well. If you're thinking about maintaining a display board when traveling, particularly on a plane, don't take a little bag of spare snow effects with you.
That would probably be construed as a problem.
It is. You don't want to have to explain any suspicious small plastic bags.
Well, let's take a quick commercial break, and then when we come back on the other side, we'll talk to Andy all about Andy 2D6.
Hey, I'm Joe.
And I'm Ryan, and we're the Hobby Heroes Podcast, covering King's War and Wild West Exodus.
We do our best to put a narrative slant to our hobby by playing games with some crazy rules and really different scenarios.
So check us out on iTunes and at thehobbyheroes.com.
And follow us on Twitter at Hobby Heroes Cast. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Counter Charge. And next up, let's talk background with Mr. Andy 2D6. Where did the name Andy 2D6 come from?
Well, the name itself, I'd run YouTube channels in the past on different topics that didn't feature my name in any way. And I thought, you know what, I kind of want people to refer to me by my actual name, because all through my internet history on websites and forums, I'd always signed up under different names. So I've still got friends to this day that just call me things that aren't my name because they're somehow related to a username I once used. There was a whole community of online gamers at one point that used to know me as Horse because of a name I used on Steam for a while. So I thought I'll put Andy in the title because it would be nice for people to call me Andy for a change. And then 2D6 was just, well, it's wargaming. That's kind of a typical dice roll that you're going to make, especially back in the old Warhammer Fantasy for leadership tests and so on. And that was the game I was playing at the time. So it seemed to make sense.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, where are you from?
Well, I am from Manchester, England. Although my accent, people can't often place it because, how to put this politely, often people from Manchester sound slightly more peasantly, shall we say, than I do. And I've probably, if anyone is listening to this from my local area, they're probably on the way around here with pitchforks right now. But I got into wargaming back in the day when I was but a wee lad. And one of my cousins actually had some miniatures. It was kind of the old school stuff, 40K, but with a land speeder made out of deodorant or something. You know, the kind that you've seen over the years.
Absolutely.
And he was really into it, and that got me interested. And my brother and I, we purchased a couple of models just from totally random systems, like a wizard, a Necromunda model, a space marine. None of them actually went together until eventually we decided we should probably actually get a boxed game. So I bought Epic Titan Legions. That was the first boxed game I got back in the day from my local GW store. And one of my friends bought Warhammer 40,000 second edition, I think it was, with the Space Marines and the single pose Gretchen that everyone fondly remembers. And I found that Epic Titan Legions was too difficult to wrap a child's brain around. And the models were quite fiddly to paint as well. So we ended up gravitating towards 40K, which then led into fantasy. And we kind of flip-flopped between those two game systems for the next, how many years? The next 10 years or so, maybe. And then I completely dropped out of the hobby for a while because everyone I knew either moved or I moved or they stopped playing. So I did hold on to my dwarves, though. Those were the only army that I actually kept because I liked the paint job on them. And then I was inspired to get back into wargaming in about 2012 when I started browsing YouTube. And I just saw a random video in my suggested video bar, which just popped up by complete random. I wasn't searching for it on, I think the first one I saw was probably a Beasts of War video on something like a new Necron codex. And I thought, hey, I wonder what's going on with Games Workshop and all that stuff now. So I started clicking around, looking at all the juicy content that was available out there. And then I was inspired to add a few models to my dwarf army. And obviously Warhammer was in the 8th edition at that stage. And I got in contact with one of my old buds that played Halflings back in the day. And we had a game. And then I pretty much set up the YouTube channel around that time as well, inspired by seeing other people doing similar channels. And I thought, you know what, I could do that. And I could have a kind of log of all my hobby stuff, because I felt like I'd done a lot over the years that was never going to be remembered. All the models I'd painted and got rid of, there was no real record of them, because I wasn't documenting it, obviously, back in the day. So I thought, if I'm documenting everything I'm doing on YouTube, there's going to be a permanent record. Even if my house burns down, people will still see what was in my army and the journey that I went through with those miniatures. So that was the idea behind the channel. I think this story is kind of jumping all over the place now.
Obviously, you've ascended to a much, much higher place. Super popular. In fact, you know, your channel, it's got the momentum of Runaway Freight Train. You know, what do you contribute this popularity to?
Well, I would say it has something to do with the fact that, in essence, I am a fountain, if you will, that sprays out nothing but charisma and juicy, red-hot wargaming goodness. I would put it mostly down to that.
And I would say maybe the color orange.
That is quite important, actually. People do often ask, of course, what's with the color orange? And it may surprise you to learn that a few years ago, I did not wear any orange at all. I just wore very, very bland colours, kind of dark blues and blacks and so on. And I thought, you know, I would like to wear something a bit more interesting and stand out a bit. So I was just shopping one day and I saw an orange T-shirt and I thought, that'd be fun. I'll wear that. And then people commented on it and thought it was fun. So I decided, well, if they like one orange T-shirt, how will they feel about an entire orange wardrobe? And then it's become a brand after that. People associate me with that color. So I wear it, I get recognized. Even if people don't know my channel, they know, hey, there's that orange guy. And they're more likely to look up my videos probably then. So it does help with branding as well.
Well, it certainly makes you much easier to spot in some random tournament, you know, photograph from the internet.
It does. I think psychologically, people know which table I'm on all the time at tournaments. Because obviously it's like an orange beacon standing out in this sea of grey and blandness that everyone else seems to bring to the table. So if they're on the top tables and I'm slowly working my way up, they can see me all the way. And it plants something in their mind, I think, that they need to be concerned about my ascension.
So obviously you play a lot of Kings of War, a lot of Age of Sigmar. What other games are you currently playing?
Well, currently playing, not much, but I do occasionally play 40K and Bolt Action and Relics and Drop Zone Commander. I haven't played Drop Zone Commander for a really long time, actually. But I've still got armies for all these games just sitting in drawers. I've got several Dreadball teams sitting in a box somewhere. I've got just drawers and drawers and cases full of miniatures for game systems. And at the moment, I'm not running out of space, so I don't feel the need to get rid of them.
What about your local gaming scene? I know you travel to various tournaments around the UK, but you know, what's your local gaming scene look like?
Well, funnily enough, I don't have much of an idea what my local gaming scene looks like because I haven't really been to any gaming clubs much or any events locally other than tournaments, mainly Kings of War. So really, I only know about the Kings of War scene. I'm sure other games do have quite a big following. I just don't attend any of it because I'm not the kind of guy who just turns up to some kind of gaming venue and just makes friends with everybody and challenges people to games. Typically, I like the online method of working up to communicating with people slowly over the course of several weeks and getting to know them a bit that way before actually playing games with them. Unless it's in a tournament setting where you just kind of thrust against somebody across the table, but then you don't have to arrange it yourself, so there's pressure off then.
You do travel to quite a bit of tournaments in the UK. Kind of talk about that. Do you have a range? Like some people say, well, I won't travel more than, you know, 2 hours. Do you have a range? And what are some of your favorite events?
Well, my range is typically however far anybody is willing to drive me, because I don't drive, so I do rely on the kindness of others to transport me around to events. And of course, it's kind of a privilege for them to kind of chauffeur me around and have some of that A-list celebrity status rub off on them by my presence attending a tournament alongside them. And as far as favorite events, so far, I'm not usually a big fan of two-day tournaments because they usually involve staying somewhere other than home. But there was a two-day event recently, Fools of War, which was very close to me, so I didn't have to stay elsewhere. So that was probably the most fun one I've had so far, mainly because it was a lot of games, and I just like long tournaments with plenty of games. So even if someone loses a game, they've still got a chance to win the tournament, which I like. I don't like the kind of maybe 3 or 4 games where you have to have a 100% record. So if you have an unlucky first game, then that's really it. You've got nothing to play for the rest of the day other than maybe aiming to finish 4th or something.
Darren, I think, ran that event, didn't he?
And he's quite a proficient tournament organizer. I'll give him that.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure about his skills as a player. I don't think I've ever played against him, so I can't attest to that.
I actually think he's a very good player. I think his problem is he just doesn't know how to write a list.
One of the things I really like about Kings of War is that lists don't automatically win you games. There are a lot of game systems out there where you'll see the two lists and you just know who's going to win automatically because it's very difficult to stop units doing their job. If you look at something like 40K, for example, it's difficult to stop any one unit from doing what it was put on the table to do. Whereas in Kings of War, you have all these different maneuvering options. You can get out of line of sight and so on. You can't just charge off wherever you like unless you take a ton of individuals, obviously. But you get the idea. I think with Kings of War, most of the victory is dependent on what you do on the table, especially compared to other game systems.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, especially coming from Warhammer 8th edition, like myself, where it was a list-building game for all intents and purposes. I mean, you could show up at the table and know, oh, that Dark Elf player is going to do this, this, and this.
You can build a really potent list purely to kill the opponent, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to win the scenario. Because the variety of scenarios in Kings of War is something I really like now, especially with some of the new ones that have come in. I especially like Eliminate, actually, with the bounty on the really expensive units.
That might be my favorite one as well. We actually just played it yesterday at a tournament in Jackson, Tennessee, and the more I play it, the more I just really enjoy, well, just in general, I love the fact that Kings of War is really less about killing your opponent and more about objective-based scenarios. And, you know, it makes for, one, I hate to say it, but, well, I love to say it, it makes gun lines less effective, right? Because it's not really about just killing your opponent. It's about going out and doing something. But two, it really pushes you or suggests to the player that you should bring a balanced list that can do a lot of different things. Because you need various tools to do different things.
You can bring a completely unbalanced list and almost guarantee yourself kind of lower mid-table finish, because there's going to be a list that you'll steamroll if you just take nothing but counters to a particular thing. But if you're not balanced, you're also going to run into a couple of lists that you can just do nothing with. So I like that. It doesn't force you to take a balanced list, but it nudges you in the direction of taking one.
And out of the new scenarios, you know, which one's your favorite? Is it Eliminate the one that you love the most?
I think it probably is, because under the idea of super units, generally it's something that you would want to get into close combat. Typically, the really expensive units, the big, nasty, powerful ones that are just going to be charging in and killing everything. But it makes you hesitate a bit, because you're then putting it in harm's way. So is it really worth you charging in and killing that enemy unit that may not be one of their bounty units and putting yourself in a position to be countercharged? That's what I like about it. And also, you can't just shoot off the most expensive units and win the game that way, unless you've got some other parts of your strategy as well.
Rewind the clock a little bit. You know, how did Mantic Games ever get on your radar?
Well, one word, zombies. I think the first time I heard Mantic mentioned, I told you the first videos I found online were Beasts of War, and I think they were analyzing the new Vampire Counts army book for Warhammer. And they were talking about how many zombies they would need and how ridiculously expensive it was going to be, and how GW's zombies were all hideous with the big gigantic hands that were bigger than any of their other body parts. And they said, well, what about Mantic zombies? And then they all had a good laugh about that. And then I looked into Mantic and found that their zombies actually looked considerably more attractive than GW's, and they were about half the price as well. And even more, if like me, you just squeeze as many out of it as possible by putting like spines on the base and counting that as a zombie, even though it doesn't have any legs or torso, but it's a spine, so it counts as a model for MMC purposes. So that got me onto buying lots of Mantic models for my Vampire Counts army. And then it was kind of a logical progression that I would eventually use it for Kings of War. I tested out Kings of War for the first time at one of the Mantic Open days. I took a couple of undead units down there with me. It would have been Kings of War First Edition, when the Zombie Legion would have been called like an Endless Swarm, I think. Back in the First Edition, I think it was called. So I had a ton of zombies out there and I had fun with it. The actual gigantic kind of demo game wasn't that great, because it was one of those, well, as soon as a unit dies, let's just bring it back on again, so it's never actually going to end, so you're going to be stuck at this table for the next 6 hours. So eventually you kind of have to walk away from it and do something else. But I thought the rules were pretty interesting at that point. And then I heard about Second Edition coming out, so I kind of held off on it. I didn't want to dive in too much to Kings of War First Edition while Second Edition was kind of on the agenda. And then with the Kickstarter, I backed that for the Second Edition rulebook and all the new fancy tokens and all that stuff. And while that was kind of building up before it was released, the Second Edition, I started constructing my Goblin army, so I'd be ready for the Second Edition when it hit. And it wasn't completely ready, which is why I used Undead for the first couple of tournaments that I went to, once I really dived into Second Edition, once that hit. And then my Goblin army was ready. I took that to a few tournaments, switched back to Undead, back to Goblins again. So I just kind of jumped between those two armies. I enjoy playing both of them. Goblins, they're just fun. Even the yellow-bellied rule. And even though I probably forget to do it about 40% of the time, it's still a lot of fun. And I just think the models look really cool, the Goblins. Apart from the regular Goblin infantry, which I think are terrible. But the Fleabag Riders, the Trolls are really nice. So I try to squeeze in as many of those as possible. And the Undead, I just like the Surge shenanigans that you can do. And the lack of wavering, because I do tend to get wavered a lot.
So looking at Second Edition, are there any changes you would like to see made?
That's an interesting one. There's not too much that jumps out at me as being wrong with this edition. There are maybe a couple of tweaks I would like to see. I think when they added more spells, I think that was a good move. I would like to see even more options with spells, with different mechanics available through spells, other than the ones that are currently available. And I like how they were thinking outside the box with the kind of blood boil type spells. I'd like to see them think more like that. And eventually, I wouldn't mind seeing some kind of magic system that makes it different from just a shooting attack. I think they could come up with something that doesn't slow down the game too much, but has that kind of that drama that the old Warhammer Magic system had without being so ridiculously overpowered. I think they could do something with that. I think rules for buildings, I'm not sure about units inhabiting buildings the way they used to do in Warhammer, but I think they could do something more with structures. I think they could. There's a way they could do it, and they could keep it quite simple. Other than that, I don't think there's a huge amount I would change with second edition at the moment. I'm sure there are a couple of units that I think are overpowered, but nothing that immediately jumps out as horribly broken.
Thinking about the Organized Play supplement, you know, what are some of the favorite changes in that book?
Well, other than the new spells, I just like all the new scenarios. I think the old scenarios were good, but people were able to build a list that could kind of cater to all of them because they were quite limited in what the objectives actually were. It was really just be in a certain position, pick this thing up, and that was really it, wasn't it? It's where your unit is at the end of the game or what it's carrying, whereas the new scenarios have brought in quite a few different objectives, which I like, and I wouldn't mind seeing even more in the future. I wouldn't mind seeing a kind of a scoring that progresses throughout the game so that maybe at the end of each turn you amass victory points for being in a particular zone rather than just at the end of the game. And I think that edges it even further away from just being a game of kill everything, which is what I like. I very much like scenario play rather than killing things, which if anyone's seen any of my tournament reports, the one thing that usually lets me down is that I don't kill enough enemy models, but I do tend to win the scenario more often than not.
Will the organized playbook affect, you know, how you build an army or your play style?
I thought it might affect my undead army construction. Because when I saw Bloodboil, I thought, that just looks like the perfect counter to a zombie legion. A spell that can just throw a ton of dice if there's already a ton of damage on something. And it's perfect against high nerve, low defense units. And I often take two zombie legions in a list. So I thought, well, if that's the perfect counter, maybe I should consider not taking those anymore. But it doesn't seem like people are really spamming Bloodboil. It's not as overpowered as people immediately cried that it might be. So I think that's the main one that made me think twice about my army list building.
You touched a little bit on it. You've got undead and goblins. Do you have any other armies?
I do have a dwarf army that I've used in one or two games, which is my old Warhammer army, which I think is from Fantasy 5th or 6th edition. Some of the models are from like 4th edition, I think, because I collected dwarves on and off for many, many years. So that army is currently sitting in a drawer on movement trays. So I can use it for Kings of War, but it's difficult to actually form a list because the unit sizes were built for kind of Warhammer 7th edition, really, or 6th edition. So the units are quite small. I don't have huge amounts of everything. And they're mainly units of 20, which, of course, doesn't unlock that much stuff. So I can't fit in all the war machines I would want to. But I have got a list ready at some point that I would like to use with, you know, the good old triple organ gun, an engineer with it, and some of the war machines, and then various small units. Of course, I don't have any Brock Riders because it's all old GW dwarves, and they seem to be kind of the MVPs of the dwarf list. So other than that, nothing else really, unless you count the ogre army that isn't really an ogre army that I haven't had a chance to use yet.
What's next on the horizon for you? Do you have an army in mind that you want to work on? Is it the ogres, or is it...
Well, I don't think I need to do too much with them, really. I just need to dry brush the movement trays. So that's going to be fairly quick. All the models are already painted. And that's going to be a 2,000-point list, as bizarre as the list will actually be, with like mammoths and chariot hordes in it. But apart from that, at some point, I would like to have an abyssal army that's painted kind of pink and flowery. That's one of my goals. At some point in the future, I just like the idea of all these tiny little devils, like hippie devils almost. I think that'd be quite amusing on the table, rather than just being the typical red that everyone uses. So at some point down the line, I would like to do that.
So Kings of War, one of the big selling points to a lot of people is this unit or diorama basing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, other than the fact that it saves me money by using 21 models for a horde and that kind of thing, but mainly I think it brings a lot more of the hobby out of people. When you're just basing everything individually, you don't really have the opportunity to do much in that regard, unless you figure out which model is supposed to stand where and chop like a corpse in half and put half of it on each model's base, which is just an absolute nightmare. But really, there's nothing you can't do. I've seen some really over-the-top things. and proxying as well, using like huge great unclean ones as zombie units and that type of thing. And with I started it kind of with my goblins. That was my first purpose-built Kings of War army. So I started experimenting with different things on the bases, like skeleton horses and fences that the models are jumping over and things like that. I think it makes it a lot more interesting rather than just painting the same posed dude over and over and over and then ranking them up. I think diorama bases are a big part of what makes the hobby side of Kings of War interesting to me.
I agreed. I think it's an evocative approach to hobby where you can actually tell a story. And it's like you said, it breaks it up. It's, you know, painting the same Iron Breaker, you know, the same exact pose 20 times can be rather mind-numbing. But now it kind of frees you up to say, okay, I'm going to change this guy a little bit and put him over here, and he's shooting this goblin, and, you know, so, and, yeah, the undead are perfect, too, you know, showing the zombies coming out of the ground, over, coming out of a cemetery, over fences, you know, it's, it opens up a lot of opportunity.
And the good old metal models aren't bashing their elbows against each other and chipping paint off either when they're all just multi-based from the start, so they're not touching each other, because that was always a nightmare in Warhammer Fantasy back in the day. I remember I used to have a dwarf runesmith that used to sit on the corner of my Ironbreaker unit, and he had a book that would constantly get poked by someone's elbow, and I would be repainting that like every 3 weeks. It was a bit of a nightmare. And so you don't really have that issue.
Yeah, and with Warhammer having to rank up your guys, a setup is so fast. You just pull the unit up, put it on the table. It's good to go.
Yep. In some ways, you could even describe Kings of War as a skirmish game when you're basing all your models just on the tray, because you're not taking off individual casualties and you're just pushing around these 10 or 15 models, if you will, that just happen to have huge bases. So, yeah, I really like it. It's very, very quick.
Well, let's take a quick commercial break. And on the other side, we're going to chat with Andy2D6 about running a successful YouTube channel.
Hey, Jack.
Hey, Rob.
Have you heard of Dead Zone, the podcast before?
Yes. Yes, I have. And where would you find that?
That would be at deadzonegame.podbean.com.
Dead Zone, the podcast. Come to deadzonegame.podbean.com to check us out. News, reviews, a lot of talking. Come check out the Dead
Zone. Back to Countercharge. So next, we're going to talk to Andy about running a successful YouTube channel. So let's start at the top. You know, where did the inspiration to start a YouTube channel come from?
Well, there were several of the channels out there at the time in about 2012. And I thought, I could do this. I could probably do it better than a lot of them. I think I'm an inherently funny guy. Some people may disagree with that. But I think I've got something to share with the world. So I was previously doing a YouTube channel reviewing PC games as a kind of a funny, stereotypical English gentleman in a top hat and a monocle being overly polite about games, because there were a lot of people being angry about games and I was going the complete opposite route of being polite. But I didn't really enjoy the kind of distant interaction with the audience. Whereas with wargaming, it's all very much a community and you can actually go and meet up with all these people that comment on your videos and play games with them and share painting tips with them. And I always enjoyed that aspect of it. So I thought I'll probably get a bit more interaction if I start a YouTube channel in this realm instead. So I already had kind of the knowledge of video editing and using a green screen for comedic effect and things like that. So I thought I'll do kind of wargaming comedy skits, I suppose you would call them. And some of them people didn't really get. I found especially Americans didn't realize I was joking with a lot of the stuff I was doing, because it's not kind of in your face, haha, I'm joking, here's some canned laughter kind of comedy. It was more like, here's something really bizarre. You're supposed to know this isn't my real personality. And there, that is the joke. So people didn't always get that, which it didn't necessarily turn me away from doing comedy, but it made me focus also on doing slightly more serious videos as well. When I realized people were interested in my opinion on war games, and I feel like I can speak eloquently about my thoughts on various game systems, and I think I can make it entertaining enough so that people want to listen to it. So I started doing more serious videos and battle reports, which I can still inject plenty of comedy into without it being over the top and silly, and it can actually be quite informative as well. So it went from there, and eventually it became more and more serious, where I just completely stopped doing the kind of silly characters, and they only became a really occasional thing. And now it's mostly analysis of games and battle reports and the various weekly shows I do. Of course, there's the Andy and Rem show, which is Age of Sigmar related, where we just look at all the new Age of Sigmar releases with a very, very lighthearted tone. And then on my Friday show, quite a few of those are about Kings of War, but generally that's a little bit more serious because I'm often on my own just talking, giving my opinions on whatever the hot topic is of the week in wargaming, which for me often is Kings of War. And battle reports are quite a big deal for me. The editing process is never fun for battle reports. The longest I've ever spent editing one was probably about 8 hours. That would have been kind of a still image battle report where I talk over it and then sync everything up and put beautiful transitions between all the images and then line up like theme music for all the different characters in the video. And that can take a really long time.
You know, if you had to distill your channel down to an elevator pitch, what would it be?
Lighthearted yet informative wargaming content mainly focused on fantasy games such as Kings of War and Age of Sigmar. That's a very, very short elevator pitch.
Your channel's been running for a while. How long has it been running?
My first video was mid-2012, I think. So I've been going for about 5 years now.
And over the years, you know, what are some of the significant changes in the channel?
The subscriber change, the number of subscribers has changed quite significantly. For the first maybe 3.5 years, then I was kind of stuck between like 700 and 900 subscribers. It kind of hit a bit of a ceiling. And then as soon as Age of Sigmar was announced, I was really the first channel to jump on that and start talking about it at length and started doing weekly shows analyzing all the latest rumors and releases. So for the first few months of that game being out, typing in Warhammer Age of Sigmar on YouTube would have transported my videos straight to the top of the search bar. So like the page one was dominated by my videos for a long time. So that sent my subscriber count up from somewhere around 1,000 up to about 2,300 in the space of a couple of months, I think. So that was the big one. Then it hit another wall, which coincided with me covering Kings of War, actually, because people don't like variety, which is weird to think about, but people want channels that are focused on whichever game they're playing, typically. So even if you do a lot of content they like, if you also do 50% of your videos on other game systems, then there's a chance they'll just unsubscribe because it's cluttering up their subscription page with things they don't want to see. So I kind of had to make a choice. Do I want to just focus purely on this one game system that's getting me lots of subscribers each day and could exponentially grow? Or is that a risk that I'll get tired of that game and then I'll have nowhere to go? Do I just want to focus on things I enjoy and videos I want to make, and then people will just subscribe if they feel like it, because it's never going to make me a millionaire regardless of how many thousands of subscribers I get? And in the end, I went with that. I just started covering what I like, and Kings of War is a big part of that.
Yeah, and so I guess the choice you made was you're just going to continue to cover whatever you fancy.
Exactly.
Well, it keeps it from getting stale, too. I know that's, in our past, we used to cover, you know, a plethora of games, but we were only playing Kings of War. And so we finally made the decision, well, we probably just need to stop pretending that we're playing a lot of Dead Zone or Dreadball or even Warhammer Fantasy and just focus on what we were playing, which was Kings of War. But I do see some actual data to what you're saying about numbers versus, you know, when you have a channel that's dedicated versus, you know, many game systems. Because when we were Mantic Radio, when we were covering all kinds of things, you know, we did not get the numbers. And now that we are geared just to Kings of War, we're certainly getting the more numbers, and that's mainly because we're getting the hardcore Kings of War follower.
Yeah, that's the thing. The hardcore people are the ones that are going to be searching out a lot of the videos and podcasts. And if it's a scattered approach where you're not focused on one thing, they may not stick around. But if you put out that your channel, this is a resource for this one game system, if you're into this game system, this is a channel you have to watch, then that definitely helps with numbers.
You know, the other thing too is whether it's a YouTube channel or a podcast, I think there's two kinds of channels, and there's ones that I think are really about content, where you're subscribing in to either learn something or, as you say, a resource. And then there's ones that are about the people. You're really just tuning in because you want to just you like these people. And I think your channel in particular has done a good job of kind of melding the two, right? You're giving some useful information, but at the same time, I think that you're engaging and you're actually, people want to watch what you're doing, right? Or the rest of your guests, they want to interact with you.
Yeah, the thing is, people don't click on personalities, but they do stay for personalities. So you want them to click on your content because it's a game they're interested in, and you want them to stick around because they like the sound of you talking. I think that's the gist of it.
Patreon, I know the proliferation of Patreons, it's increased over the years. You know, how has that affected your channel?
To varying degrees, because first of all, the reason I originally started a Patreon was because on the Andy and Rem show, obviously we were covering Age of Sigmar, but we live a few hours apart, so we weren't able to actually play many games against each other. So we thought, well, if the audience want to see us playing more games together, then why don't we ask them if they want to fund that? And then people were willing to do so. So it got up into pretty decent figures for a while, but then Mr. Remington Steele, my co-host, doesn't really have the time to do that anymore, so it's been reined back a bit and put the Patreon on the back burner, and then I kind of rebranded it a bit and put out that it's now just for any battle reports I make. If you want to support the channel, then this will just help me get more terrain to make them look prettier, help me justify spending 6 hours editing videos and get more armies to add more variety to the games. And that, at the moment, let me see here, it's sitting at $52 per month, which is more than I make from YouTube. Let me put it that way. So it's definitely very, very welcome, because YouTube payments are very sporadic. Unless you're raking in like thousands of views every single day, then it's definitely not something to make a living with.
And let's be honest, you're not really covering the salacious type of content that will get the eyes drawn. You know, you're not... Some of the channels out there make me shake my head sometimes on YouTube.
If you want to have a really successful Patreon, you should probably either be covering one of the mammoth game systems, like 40K. 40K Battle Reports would be really good. 40K Tactics, or any kind of painting tutorials, because they're kind of non-specific enough so that they can be applied to any range of miniatures. So if you put out a video, how to paint non-metallic metal, for instance, people are going to be searching that for years to come. You're going to get a lot of hits on that. And if you do regular tutorials of some kind, painting is a really good example, then people are going to want to support you so they can keep learning from you.
We would be remiss if we didn't mention that if you just put an Andy2D6 on Patreon, it will come right up. It's patreon.com/Andy2D6.
Yes, and that will help my battle report content immensely. Feel free to give generously.
Who's the driving force behind the channel? I mean, are you coming up with the topics?
It's pretty much entirely me, and especially anyone who follows the Andy and Rem show will know that Mr. Remington Steele is very much a show up when he feels like and talk about whatever I've put on the agenda type of guy, and he's quite happy to do that, which is fine because he doesn't get any of the YouTube money. But other than that, there obviously are the people that appear on my channel as guests quite a lot. There is Dreddy, who has appeared in a lot of my Age of Sigmar battle reports and appears on a lot of my live shows. She's just happy to help out as well. And the various other regulars. I tend not to have a huge amount of different guests. There's a couple of reasons. First of all, I like the familiarity of talking with the same people a lot, because you can kind of build up chemistry with them. I've listened to a lot of shows and podcasts where they have a different guest every week, and occasionally, now I'm not going to say that your podcast is like this, I know you have the same people on quite a bit, if you have different people constantly, it can be difficult to get into a flow with them, and it ends up feeling more like kind of a stale, kind of sterile professional interview rather than a fun, interesting chat between buds, which is what people like listening to, I think.
It's a real delicate thing to try to find guests that can make for engaging conversation, especially if you've never really had the chance to meet them, you know, and actually interact with them on a personal level. So it's a challenge for sure.
And appearing on something like this, usually 99% of the content I put out, I'm the host. So I'm used to just constantly talking and driving the conversation. So I'm having to rein myself in not to just talk over you and just throw jokes in the middle of your sentences and pitches.
Well, we appreciate the that because that's a lot less editing for me. So that's awesome. And on that note, you know, I'm assuming you do all the editing for the channel?
Yes, 100%. Which sometimes it's a huge amount. Some weeks there's virtually nothing. If I'm doing nothing but live shows, although saying that, there was an amusing incident a couple of weeks ago on the Andy and Rim show where Mr. Remington Steele accidentally screen shared some pictures that he probably shouldn't have done. So I'd had to go in and edit that with the handy new YouTube editing tools where you can actually edit the video after it's been uploaded. Some weeks there's no editing at all. Usually there's a bit at least. It just, it is kind of soul draining video editing after a while, but it's usually worth it. But then when I look at my YouTube viewing figures and I'll see, so I've got an example here, Battle Report, Kings of War, Undead versus Elves, 477 views. And that took a couple of hours to edit all that together. And then I see a video that took me 26 seconds to record where I just opened a box that took about 3 minutes of editing. And that is already almost at 300 views, even though it only went up yesterday. So sometimes it can get disheartening when you see that people are clicking on the content that was really easy to create and neglecting the content that takes a lot of time and effort and love and energy and sweat and tears and blood that were poured into it. But generally, it's worth it. One of the reasons I don't do 40K battle reports anymore, because I used to, whenever I played a game of 40K, I would video it at the same time and then make a battle report on that. But I didn't feel like there was enough of an audience on my channel for that kind of content. They were getting like maybe 300 views per battle report. So the people of my channel obviously weren't that interested in it. It wasn't really getting any comments. So I decided I'll just take pictures of those games and then maybe talk about it on one of my live shows, which doesn't take any editing at all. So it doesn't matter if no one cares about it.
You know, over the years, what have been the highlights from running a successful YouTube channel?
Generally, the highlights, other than, of course, the endless financial rewards that pay for my helicopter landing pad and fleet of limos, and the hot tub which I'm sitting in right now. Other than that, I would say probably being recognized at events and tournaments, because even before my channel grew to the level it was now, at a tournament, at a fantasy tournament I went to, 8th edition, a few years ago, one of the games, I introduced myself to my opponent and he just said, "I know." And that was like, that's one of the highlights, definitely, of running a channel.
Yeah, it's funny when you introduce yourself and they go, "Oh yeah, I know who you are." I was like, "Oh okay, that's all right." It's kind of sometimes it's disconcerting because you forget sometimes that actually there are maybe 5 or 6 people that actually listen to this stuff. So
often I'm not sure if I'm supposed to know them as well. So there's kind of that awkward moment where you're trying to work out, do I know this person? Because when it comes to recognizing people's names and faces, usually I have to meet them twice and then it's permanently imprinted. But the first meeting just completely disappears usually. So it's potential for awkwardness if someone comes up to me and I'm not sure whether I know them or not.
When you record bat reps, which seems like an amazing amount of work, you know, what are some important things to consider?
Well, you have to think about what kind of battle report you're going to do, because there are obviously several different kinds that are the main ones out there that people do. There's the end of turn recaps, which are probably the most common ones I do. I either do end of turn, or if it's a really busy game, just end of phase if it's a big game. So they can take quite a bit of editing to line up all the clips, and obviously the more clips you have, the more chopping at the beginning and end you have to do. And there's also the still image ones where you just talk over them, which if you're doing live, take very little editing. If you're putting a lot of effort and time into them to make them look nice, they can take a really long time. And there's the I'm just going to film the whole thing battle reports, which I'm not really sure they should qualify as battle reports if you're just filming the entire game. And some people film the entire game and then chop it, lots of quick cuts so that you just see all the important dice rolls and that kind of thing. So you have to think about what kind of content you actually want to do, and whether that is what your audience wants and whether you're suited to that. If you're not the most talkative type, then showing off the entire game probably isn't going to be a good thing, because there's going to be a lot of silence if you're pondering your moves the whole time, unless that's the whole point of the video. So you have to think where your strengths lie and then play to them. There are other factors you have to take into consideration as well regarding the actual footage. Like, are you going to be recording the audio separately? Are you going to be recording it through your camera? You have to make sure that the sound's coming through okay, that no one's rustling pages in the background while you're summing up what's happening during the turn. If you're using an external recorder, how much battery life is there in it? All the various pitfalls technically that you can run into. What's the lighting like? Which side of the table should you be recording from? Is there a glare on the nice shiny battle mat that you've got on the table? Is that going to look weird if you film it from a particular angle? So there's lots of things to consider. And is there the continuity? Last time you took a picture of something, had you moved a unit to a particular location and then at the end of the turn you realized it wasn't allowed to do that? So did you then move it back and then not address that and not explain to the audience what's going on? So there's a lot of things to consider.
So there's lots of YouTubers out there. Anybody doing really great bat reps besides you?
Well, of course not. For the most part, I'm not a huge watcher of other people's battle reports, because usually when I'm watching, in quotation marks, YouTube videos, I'm more like listening, because I'm usually painting or assembling models at the time. So with battle reports, they're a very visual medium, I think, where you have to be looking at the screen the majority of the time. So I probably prefer, if I'm going to watch battle reports, though, I would like the still image ones more likely, unless they do that really slow zoom feature that people use. Usually when they're making battle reports on their phones, they'll have kind of the standard features, like you can do a slow zoom to make it look like the video's moving when really it's not. But really that just gives me a headache, so I wish people wouldn't do that. But I would prefer videos where I don't have to be looking at the screen the whole time. So I'm not a big watcher of battle reports, really. I'm sure there are plenty of good ones out there. There's some really well-produced ones. I'm just not a big consumer of them. So it depends on the game system as well, because with Kings of War, typically people aren't looking for in-depth, narrative, kind of story-driven battle reports. Kings of War is more so a competitive game than something like Age of Sigmar, where people are really just interested in the story and maybe the comedy side of it that I bring. With Kings of War, especially with my tournament recaps, I try to go in serious detail about what my thought process was behind all the strategies that I'm actually using. And then I make sure to take a ton of pictures to illustrate it properly. And I'm sure it works against me, because people know what all my tactics are when they come up against me in tournaments. So maybe that's why I have to switch between armies so much.
In terms of novice YouTubers, do you have any advice for somebody that's an up-and-comer that wants to build a channel to your high esteemed level?
Play to your strengths, but on the other hand, there is something to be said for going a little bit outside your comfort zone. There's a difference between going outside your comfort zone and going beyond your strengths, though. If you're really good at talking on camera, if you're really engaging with people, then doing a video that's just the camera pointing at the desk while you paint something maybe isn't going to be the best thing for your particular talents. So figure out what you're good at, figure out how you are most entertaining to people, and then go from there would be the main one. Also, don't go in with high expectations unless you are going to put a lot of time and energy and resources into it, because there are some channels that pop up. Clearly, they want to do it for a job because they've immediately got the professional logos and t-shirts and they've got all the equipment set up. Just immediately from their first video, you know this is going to be a professional operation. You've got a chance of immediately making it big to a point when you do that. But there are a lot of those channels that start up and then they kind of slow down horribly, or they disappear when they realize that perhaps it's not the instant money-making venture that they hoped for. There have been quite a few channels like that over the years. So make sure it's sustainable is a really important thing. Don't do content that just completely exhausts you too regularly. Make sure you break it up and keep it so that it's fun, because if it stops being fun, then eventually you're going to burn out. And even if you're getting lots of new subscribers and feedback on everything, if it's just exhausting you, then you're not going to be able to continue. So make sure you can sustain the level of output. So don't go all out too fast and spoil people expecting 5 videos a week, and then eventually you will have to slow down. So those are a few important tips, I think.
So what's the future hold? I mean, obviously you've got, what, 3,000 subscribers, I think, right now?
It's just below 3,000 at the moment.
Where are we going to be in a year? Are we going to be at 10,000, 12,000?
Well, I would say no, because of the big variety of content that I do on my channel. Obviously, that it puts some people off, like we were talking about. So I would be happy if at the end of this year I had, let's say, another 300 or so. There was a point I was getting 10 new subscribers a day when I was doing nothing but Age of Sigmar videos and doing multiple a week. But obviously, I didn't want to sustain that. Now, it's usually like between 1 and 3 new subscribers a day, which is fine by me. I'm not measuring it too much on subscriber count, which is sometimes misleading as well, because I found that even though my channel is relatively small compared to some other wargaming channels, I'm more recognizable than other personalities in the community, that maybe their channel is more focused on the content rather than them as a person. So maybe they're not going to get recognized as much, which for me is an important part as well. And it justifies putting so much time into it when people come up to me and tell me that they enjoy my channel. Last time I was in America, I think someone came up to me and said, "Hey man, I follow you on Twitter." I was like, "Oh, okay. I don't really know who you are."
What event did you come to America for?
I've been to 2 Adepticons, not this year and not last year, but the 2 previous ones I attended. And the last one I went to, I was in the Warhammer Fantasy tournament, which was the first tournament of any kind that I'd been to.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, I didn't have a display board because I didn't want to transport a display board across the ocean and risk going through airport security and them just tearing it to pieces. Somehow my all-metal old dwarf gyrocopter survived every one of my like 8 plane trips somehow. And I have no idea how that happened because it usually just breaks when you look at it. If there's a slight vibration of the table, one of the propellers falls off. So I don't know how it survived 8 plane journeys, but it did. But Adepticon was really fun. I will say, though, that the general atmosphere in Warhammer Fantasy, if that tournament is anything to go by, is a lot more kind of dour and miserable than the Kings of War community, because so many people look depressed, especially on day 2. And when I put down my like dwarf artillery line, a couple of my opponents, like, they almost had their heads in their hands. Like, they suddenly started suffering from a major bout of depression at the table. Especially the one guy I actually defeated, who was the guy that recognized me from YouTube, actually. He had an ogre army, which just got mercilessly gunned down. That was the only game I actually won, though.
It's fantastic you mentioned that, though, because, you know, I played Warhammer for a long time, and I went to a lot of Adepticons. And I completely get what you're saying there, because you would go to some of those, especially Adepticon, which was pretty much one of our, you know, it's pretty much one of the biggest events we had of the year for fantasy. But it was so, half the room was just happy to be there, right? They don't care. They're not about winning. But then the other half really, really wants to win. And when their hopes go up in smoke, which, you know, 99% of the people in the room don't really have a chance of winning that event, it was so depressing. I don't know. Kings of War has been a refreshing change of pace, but it, just in general, you don't get the level of, I don't know. There are certainly fellows that are playing games, that are very difficult to play with or just not fun to play, and they're not playing Kings of War. And you know what? That makes me smile.
I think one of the good points for Kings of War is that the rules are way less obscure and fiddly when you compare them to like Fantasy 8th edition. So there are less things that people are able to abuse, definitely. Kings of War, the rules are much more clear and streamlined, and you're very unlikely to come up against something that seems totally outside the spirit of the rules but is somehow still legal.
Well, and I think you hit it on the head right there. There are people, there are gamers in our community that actually are looking for those opportunities, you know, those gotcha moments, those, oh, I am going to show you this, I'm a rules lawyer and I'm going to tweak this to do this, even though it's totally not within the spirit of the game. And in Warhammer, that was abundant.
Conga lines.
Exactly. Conga lines is one example. But yeah, I mean, the scary part for me, though, is I played for Warhammer for 20 years, but the more I play Kings of War, the more I don't even remember Warhammer. The more I don't really miss it anymore.
I don't really miss 8th edition at all. I found that all the things I liked about 8th edition Warhammer, I've now got in the split of Kings of War and Age of Sigmar. They provide, it's branched out in 2 directions, and I'm quite happy walking down both of them. So with Kings of War, I've got the, you know, the strategic, almost chess-like maneuvering of pieces. There's less random elements in play, and most of the strategy is on the table once you put the models down. whereas Age of Sigmar is more about, for me, it's more about the narrative and the craziness and the, not necessarily the silly rules, but there's a slightly more an element of randomness to it, which is another thing that I like, but I like to have a bit of both. And Fantasy VIII definitely had both those elements in it. There was a lot of crazy random things like the magic, and then there was also kind of the maneuvering and strategy. So I do like that I've been able to get two games out of one, essentially.
Well, and as a proper Age of Sigmar player, why aren't you at South Coast GT this weekend?
I don't really have that much of an interest in Age of Sigmar tournaments, to be honest. I'm not sure whether my playstyle really lends itself to that. I'm more interested in just playing the narrative Age of Sigmar games and just telling a fun story with it rather than squeezing the most cheese out of a list. And I've seen some of the kind of spam lists that some people take to the Age of Sigmar tournaments, and it doesn't sound like as much fun. Maybe I will go to one eventually just to try it out, but it doesn't immediately grab me as something I must do at this stage.
I think that's one of the things that is attractive about Age of Sigmar is it's not necessarily the gameplay mechanics, right? It's but the narrative story that you can tell. That is the one thing that Kings of War obviously doesn't deliver on that we did have in Warhammer Fantasy. There was some cool swings and roundabouts that you could get in a game that you could really have a memorable story. In Kings of War, when you're on the ropes, it's really hard to get off the ropes and to, you know, to survive.
And also, I think the fluff as well. In Kings of War, it varies from kind of thin to non-existent in places, whereas other games definitely have a lot more either fleshed out or much more creative fluff, shall we say. Kings of War was somewhat designed to be generic, I'm sure, because it wanted to appeal to those old fantasy players without infringing on any copyrights. But I would like them to completely just rewrite the entire Mantica fluff at some point and come up with something new and original.
Definitely going to do that with some of the newer armies too, like the Twilight Kin will get rewritten, and the Northern Alliance and the Ophidians. So there's certainly some opportunity, and like you said, they just really just, you know, also flesh out what they've already got. You know, when they started, they just wanted to make it marketable, which works. But now that they have a growing population of players, it's time to actually really give us and deliver us that rich world that we kind of need. I think that'll enhance the game.
There are certain moves that Mantic haven't taken, which I feel they should have done. And I've said this to people in the upper echelons of Mantic in the past. It's not going to be that much of an expense for them to create like little narrative videos explaining what this particular character in the story did, and here's the model you can buy at the end of it. It wouldn't take that much effort to do that, and it would probably just sell more models in the end and get people invested in the story at the same time. So I don't know why they haven't really got on board with that.
Yeah, I know Mark, my co-host, is a huge nut for, you know, books, short stories. And we'd love to see more. Because, I mean, that's another thing that I really liked about Warhammer was the Black Library books were fantastic. More fiction. Any of your videos that are just amazing that anybody should have to watch?
Well, considering I would imagine the vast majority of people that are either listening to this or at the very least made it to this point in this podcast are probably Kings of War nuts. So I would say my entire Kings of War Battle Reports series, the tournament reports, the earlier ones were a bit more thin because obviously it was a new concept for me and I didn't take as many pictures and I didn't go as in-depth. But the more recent ones are very, very in-depth, lots of detailed tactical analysis. And I find that the fact I've got a really good memory helps a lot for that as well. I'm sure there's some people that would have a 6-game, 2-day tournament, sit down after it and just have no idea at all what happened in turn 3 of game 2, for example. But I find I can usually remember it all quite well. So I think they're a good, valuable tactical resource for people. And there is some other Kings of War content on there. There's some Kings of War hobby stuff lurking around there as well. Some of the conversions I've done, I occasionally do a video talking about them. And at the end of each month, I do a recap of everything I've painted, which often includes something Kings of War related. So if you want to get any kind of amateur painting tips, then that's a decent place for that.
What other events do you have on your docket for this year for Kings of War?
For Kings of War, there are a couple coming up in the next month or so, and I'm not sure which ones I'm going to yet. There's one that's fairly close to me, but I haven't arranged transport to that one yet. And there's another one I want to go to, which is kind of the same thing. That's about a month later. The one tournament coming up that I'm definitely going to is actually a Dead Zone one, which is in a couple of weeks, which is close to me. So that's going to be fun. I haven't done a Dead Zone tournament for quite a few months now, so I need to get a practice game in first. But as far as Kings of War, there's nothing nailed on the calendar yet, but there are two or three coming up that I'm hoping to sign up for.
And we did get a listener question.
Ooh.
How can we get Remington Steele to play Kings of War?
Well, he has played one game of Kings of War. I nudged him into it, and he pretty much understood the rules and everything after one game, as most people do when they play Kings of War. It's just a question of, he doesn't play that many games to begin with. So, like, the one game every 4 months that he plays is generally Age of Sigmar. So I think it will be difficult to get him hardcore into Kings of War, but the fact that there are official rules for a halfling army is definitely something that sways people. Not only him, there's also my friend Halfling Pete, who featured in a couple of my early fantasy battle reports, who is interested in trying Kings of War purely because he has a huge halfling army, and GW haven't had any official rules for them really ever. And now Mantic do, so he's looking forward to giving that a try. And he may be coming for a game in a few weeks, so that should be interesting.
A side note, have you been following some of this 8th edition 40k talk that's come up this weekend?
Yes, I have. I'm actually possibly planning to record a video today where I pretend to burn a Space Marine army.
Andy, where can we, you know, follow the adventures of Andy2D6?
Well, obviously, Andy2D6 on YouTube. And if you go on, click on any of my YouTube videos, pretty much, then in the description you'll find links to my Facebook group. There's two Facebook groups. There's my kind of general Andy2D6 Orange Wargaming Facebook group, which is for all game systems. There's the Andy and Rem Show Facebook group, but that's Age of Sigmar specific. There's Andy2D6 on Twitter, which isn't that active, but I'll post things on there occasionally. And that's pretty much it, other than the Patreon.
Patreon.com/Andy2D6.
Give me all of your money.
Well, they're obviously not contributing enough, right? Because if they would contribute more, you would have more videos.
Well, there would be just constant wall-to-wall battle reports under those circumstances.
Well, Andy, thanks for coming on, chatting to us about YouTube and Kings of War and your little slice of the internet.
Well, the pleasure was all yours.
Well, that's going to do us tonight. Until next time, keep countercharging.